On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Tuesday. A minute and a half past the hour. This is the Horn, the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice, independent progressive broadcasting for more than half a decade. You got to see it. It's all about messaging, all about framing. You got to find ways of saying things that mean something. So instead of saying for 6, 7 years, whatever, in now in our 7th year, no, more than half a decade. Because, you know, there were pig lickings and wing nuts out there for all that, you know, half a decade? Jesus, you mean he's been on the air for 50 years? Right wingers, Otne, Ute, Ipre, if you own a, what I mean, may. That's code, they'll never figure it out. So, it is Tuesday. And I'm being told, I got a message saying the back door to the chat room wasn't working, but by the same token, I'm looking at folks in there who got there via the back door to the chat room, so try again. Hopefully it'll work. It feels a little bit like a catch-up or sort of a pick-up where we left off serialization of More in Monday, but really, honest to God, it's not. But there's still a, oh, wow, yeah, a bunch of stuff to get to, some of which was actually present last night that we just ran out of room for. But we'll get to it. Honest to goodness, I really do. We will try to get to every last little bit of it, as well as your calls later on in the program, because that's what this is, that's what Conversation Radio is all about. It's the 22nd day of November. Need I say more? The day was as gray and forlorn here in the hills and hollers of almost level West Bicod, Virginia, as the day was beautiful, bright, and hopeful 48 years ago today. So we will simply mark this sad, tragic anniversary and move on. A day in which I think it may be argued, and fairly, that this nation changed more than anyone might have anticipated or realized. So, there's that. I would also like to thank folks for continuing to contribute to support the broadcasts and the efforts here. We made up serious ground over the weekend, and we actually got to the halfway point for November yesterday. We got to the halfway point for November yesterday, and so that means we have from today through the 30th to make up a. It's not that deep a hole, however. All it is 125 people out of a sizable audience. 125 people. Doing $10 a piece. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. The snail mail address is also there if you prefer to work that way. And any way you choose is fine and is greatly appreciated. But, 125 $10 contributions will actually round out the month of November. So that's out of the way, too. I hate that part. I really hate that part. But then I remember I remember comments from people like our buddy John in New York, who says, for me, the horn is not a luxury, it is a necessity. And that makes me a little more willing to do this, because I know there are a number of you that feel that way. And it certainly feels that way to me as well. And to all of us who pour time into making all of this go. And so it makes it a little bit easier to mention the fact that, yeah, it would be great. It would be great to finish November in the black, because it would be the first one we finished in the black in a while. September came in just short. October came in way short. And November is looking like October at this point. So that's taken care of. Now, as far as as far as this evening is concerned, and where we start and where we go, well, I've got a leftover story from, well, it's not really leftover. I got it via email from our pop culture correspondent, David in Maine. And it seems an appropriate place to begin, just because of how vile the story is. God. You know, there's a, I was reading just a little bit ago over at The Hill, a story headlined, Insurers Terrified of Supreme Court Ruling on Healthcare Reform Law. The gist of the story is as follows. The insurance industry is terrified that the Supreme Court will strike down the individual mandate to buy insurance next year while leaving the rest of the healthcare reform law intact. There are a number of people on both sides of the aisle for whom, well, you know, the right-wingers won't be happy until they get a replacement for the Affordable Care Act that actually mandates going out and killing their political opponents, because that's how they are. But there are a number of people on our side who would be fine if the individual mandate were struck down. And I'm not wholly opposed to that idea. I far prefer the idea of single payer, or even a Medicare for all sort of situation, or even just a little old public option. But this story is interesting insofar as it continues, for insurers, the death of the mandate alone, one of many plausible outcomes in the blockbuster case, is the nightmare scenario, one Republican healthcare lobbyist told The Hill. Oh, gee, a lobbyist. Because they're going to be honest and truthful and forthright and forthcoming and upstanding. They're terrified they're going to be left holding the bag, the lobbyist said. What bag would that be, Mr. Lobbyist? Would that be the great big bag of money? You know. In arguing for the mandate, the insurance industry points to the experiences of 8 states that tried and failed to reform their insurance markets without one in the 1990s. They say the law's requirements are unworkable unless everyone in the country purchases insurance. Or unless everyone in the country has, say, the ability to sign up for Medicare, which was the original intent of Medicare in the first place. Right? Yeah. But that argument may not sway the Supreme Court, which must decide the severability of the mandate from the law, along with a host of other legal and constitutional issues. Was there a severability clause in the Affordable Care Act? I don't know. I seem to recall us discussing that. In an amicus brief filed last month with the High Court, the insurance industry said keeping the law's reforms in place without a mandate would create widespread instability in the insurance market and over time would substantially reduce access to affordable coverage. The difference between a mandateless health law with market reforms intact and without some of many of those market reforms is night and day, according to America's Health Insurance Plans in their amicus brief, or their friend of the court brief. And see, this points up the fact that the insurance industry is, of course, you know, the American people are not the greatest beneficiary of the Affordable Care Act. The insurance industry is. because it compels participation of some 36 million people in for-profit health care plans who are not presently therein. One more argument I would suggest in favor of letting people choose not to participate in a for-profit plan, but rather to participate in a plan whereby some lobster-for-lunch-eating executive does not have his or her salary tied to the sickness, the agony, the misery, the illness, the death of American citizens. So that's the background to this story. Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles is the locus of the story. The story concerns a man by the name of Norman B. Smith, 63 years old. He's been treated at Cedars-Sinai by oncologist Stephen Miles for some time now. And, of course, with liver cancer, there's a lot of nasty side effects to things like chemotherapy. And those nasty side effects can be mitigated. But the bottom line is that Norman B. Smith's name is Norman B. Smith, not Norman B. Jobs. And by definition, therefore, he cannot go, he cannot just pack up and move briefly to Memphis, Tennessee, and jump to the front of the line and get himself a shiny new liver like somebody else with that same name. No, Norman B. Smith has to sit right the hell where he is in Los Angeles, California, and hope that because see, right now, Norman B. Smith is not even on the liver list. A double entendre, that, the liver list. It's a list of people who need a liver, but it's also a list of people who will and will not be allowed to live, hence livers. No, he's not allowed to be on the liver list because... Okay. Tell the little children to leave the room. All right, little Timmy, little Susie, you can come back in a little bit. Are they gone? I don't like to just say these things where people can... I don't want to upset anybody. Norman B. Smith is a dope smoker. He smokes that marijuana. Yeah, he does. I know. He's a dope head. You want to know why Norman B. Smith is a pot smoker? Well, it's because his oncologist, Stephen Miles, prescribed cannabis for Norman B. Smith under California's medical marijuana law. Because of the aforementioned chemotherapy and various and affiliated side effects that go with it that we mentioned a few minutes ago. I mentioned, not me and that mouse in my pocket. This story coming from allgov.com. Article written by Noel Brinkerhoff. Norman B. Smith is not being allowed onto the liver transplant list because he is a consumer of cannabis. And Cedars-Sinai Medical Center's liver transplant protocols, and other transplant protocols for that matter, but liver transplant protocols decree, mandate, here's your individual mandate, that you can't get on the liver transplant list, and you can't be getting no liver transplant if you're one of them filthy dope smokers. You gotta quit smoking the marijuana and a drinking and a giving up your heathen high living ways, and you gotta do it for 6 months or they won't give you no liver. Even if the reason you're using cannabis is because your oncologist, fancy word for cancer doctor, told you to. It's not like Norman B. Smith is just hanging out eating Cheetos with his rotten liver. Dude, here. No. It's not like Norman B. Smith is calling people up and smacking himself in the side of the head, hollering, "Dude, I'm so wasted." You know, you just want to look at whoever it is that runs the Cedars-Sinai LA transplant program and say this:
"You dick!"
Exactly. Norman B. Smith, a man with liver cancer, is being treated like some addict because he's trying to live longer by being able to do things like eating, because chemotherapy's hell on your appetite. Hospital officials are insisting that Smith stop using marijuana for at least 6 months, undergo random drug testing, and participate in weekly substance abuse counseling. Hi, Norman! Hello, my name is Norman. Hi, Norman! Participate in weekly substance abuse counseling before they'll consider putting him back on the list. He was on it, and they took him off. Well, we took him off because we found out he was one of them dope smokers. There is an organization out there called Americans for Safe Access, which is a medical marijuana advocacy group, and they are publicly urging Cedars-Sinai to relist Mr. Smith for a liver transplant and to alter its transplant eligibility policy. By the way, this is not the first time this has happened. This is not the first time that a patient in need of a transplant has been denied one by Cedars-Sinai and other hospitals in the U.S. because of medical marijuana. Indeed, of course you see. But good God. This is, of course, the normal and natural and logical outgrowth of a country in the grips of a drug frenzy. Texas Betsy just sending me a quick message. She says, "My doctor's office drug tests me every single month because I'm on a narcotic once a day. There is, of course, no medical marijuana here in Texas Stan." You know, this is a moment where I get to use a new phrase I just learned. I was looking at my Facebook page earlier today, and I got a bless your heart, one of the real ones. "Bless your heart, Bob, for referring to it as Alabama Stan." She said, "I lived in Dogpatch, USA, otherwise known as Montgomery, Alabama, for 2 years, and that place is," and here's our new phrase, put it right up there with crazier than a sprayed roach, "and that place is dumber than a bag of hair." Cedars-Sinai. Dumber than a bag of hair. Well, we don't want to go giving somebody a brand new liver for them to just go out and start making it smoke the marijuana. Maybe we need, in the Congress of the United States, oh, stop it, Bob, a Norman B. Smith Act, in which people... No. I'm sure the family values, the Republican types would stop that just right away. You can almost already hear Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. My noble and esteemed fellow senators, we cannot let the scourge of marijuana infect our for-profit liver transplant system. Communist marijuana growers will be getting livers left and right that could otherwise be saved for noble and genius-laden computer executives. Amen. Yeah, no fruit cup for you, Norman B. Smith. Because this country has a punishment fetish. Because this country, we love it when we can watch it on TV, hear it on the radio, see it in the papers, and we can look at somebody and say, ah, but I'm so much better, for I am not a marijuana smoker. If I ever need a liver transplant, they won't make me go to AA for 6 months before they'll put me on the list. They won't make me sit in a room and say I was powerless over the munchies, for I am better than that. Because, you see, there's not a damn bit of medical literature that suggests that the consumption of cannabis, that's another one of those pronunciation emphases, there's no medical literature that says that the consumption of cannabis in any wise hinders, alters, or negatively impacts the transplant process.
Well, what if he was laying in that hospital bed with his oxygen tank in there and he decided to fire up a big old blunt, Bob? You know how it is with these dope smokers.
Right. Right.
What are you people? On dope?
They all are. Everybody is. Maybe this would be even a little bit different if it weren't for the fact that his oncologist, his board-certified oncologist, had looked at him and said, it takes a special person to be an oncologist. Because in the oncology gig, you do a whole lot of, of looking at people and say, well, I'd say you've got a year. Whew. That's got to be hard. And the biggest part of an oncologist's job is suffering, is mitigation of suffering. And so his oncologist looks at Norman B. Smith and says, look, it's California. You've at least got medical marijuana available to you. And if you were to brownies, I don't care how, but you'll at least be able to eat. And you got to eat to have the strength that you're going to need to beat this. And because he followed doctor's orders, he's no longer eligible for a transplant in the eyes of a bunch of Carrie Nation-esque prudes. Yeah, that's where we start. A little email along the way. Got an email here. Kind of tough on old Don Young, weren't you, last night, Bob? I moved to Alaska in 1973, the year he was first elected. Lived there for 30 years while he was a constant thorn in the side of many of us. Been back in Oregon for 8 years and had just about forgotten about that brain-dead POS. Until yesterday, you kind of touched a nerve. Like a root canal without anesthesia. You and Sandra aren't the only ones mystified by the fact that he fell into office in the first place and has been reelected so many times. Not all Alaskans are that conservative, ignorant, or bought off by the oil industry. You wondered why he doesn't just get a job with them. The possibility exists that he has. So true. And then the quote from Joseph Stalin occasionally comes to mind. Those who vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. Ooh, didn't he say a mouthful? We got a big blow coming up. I'm going to batten down the hatches on the chicken coop. Thanks again, and a wonderful Thanksgiving to everyone. So, everybody, you've just been wished a happy Thanksgiving, which I will gladly echo. And thanks for the kind contribution from News Ninja Susan. She said, I just kicked in $100. I challenged the other listeners to come up with the same. Wow. Thank you very, very much, Susan. So the challenge is there, and I will keep this, I will keep you posted on it through the course of the program. That would go, matching Susan's would go a long way toward, oh gosh, that would be, we'd be down to only needing around 100 out of those 125 kick-ins to the Thrifty 250. It can be done. It can be done. Thank you, Susan. Thank you very, very much. But that's our starting place, but I wanted to share a couple of emails with you. This one from last night. Jude writing in from the Great Northwest, based on the conversation that I was having with a liberal in South Carolina. Jude says, we have entered a time where the mindset of the ruling class is manifested clearly and defined as to what the other is. I viewed the photo of Michelle Obama's face and Bob, and she's referring to at the NASCAR event. I am unsure of when the booing had occurred, but she appeared to reveal sadness or pain, and it was present more than likely had already happened. We are in deep trouble, and the masses will be called upon to make an individual stand very soon. My question is each individual prepared to do this? For those who are pondering seriously how they will consider the movement, or how they will manifest their individual participation, please consider the movement of Women Standing, womenstanding.com. We need you, Jude notes. She says, it's all so surreal. How could a country that we find ourselves living in be the problem? But it is, and we are. The lust for power, energy, money, American ideals, and yes, control, has grounded us, be it not by our will, on the front line of our own demise. We're living in a police state country. Why are the governors not speaking out? The state senators, representatives, why are they not speaking out? Where is President Obama, who should be speaking out? Crickets is all we hear. Interesting you should mention this, Jude, because I've got something right here. President Obama got mic checked today in New Hampshire. And he even got a little note put in his hand. The little note that reached President Obama said, Mr. President, over 4,000 peaceful protesters have been arrested, while banksters continue to destroy the economy with impunity. You must stop the assault on our First Amendment rights. Your silence sends a message that police brutality is acceptable. Banks got bailed out. We got sold out. And so when President Obama got mic checked in New Hampshire, well, just listen, this is the event as it transpired.
He's getting interrupted right now by some protesters in the audience. We're listening in right now. The crowd is rallying over the protesters. We're not sure what the protesters are saying.
Listen, I'm going to be talking about a whole range of things today, and I appreciate you guys making your point. Let me go ahead and make mine, all right? And I'll listen to you. You listen to me, all right? Now, families like yours, young people like the ones here today, including the ones who were just chanting at me, You're the reason I ran for office in the first place. Because...
And the clip doesn't expand past the because. But you're the reason I ran for office in the first place. There will be a variety of opinions on that particular piece of rhetoric. I haven't seen any other postings saying that Barack Obama then followed up in his remarks by talking about reining in the profit monsters. Remember, it's the fact that we do not have the wealth to give the 1% that makes the 1% have to steal it from us. And in the collapse of the Super Congress yesterday, we saw the 1%'s willingness to continue stealing. We've all seen those old cartoons where the guy who's emptied out his pockets gets turned upside down and shaken until the last couple of nickels come rolling out. That's us. The brute holding us upside down, that's the 1%. Of course, when Barack Obama got mic checked, a group of the faithful began chanting, "Obama, Obama, Obama." You can make of that what you will. Thank you very kindly, by the way. We have support rolling in for Susan's challenge. It is much appreciated. It looks like we could actually roll over her challenge inside of the first hour, and that would be amazing. But I think Jude has noted very, very well the prospects before us. Whether we realize it or not, we're in the soup. I had an email last night after the program, or toward the end of the program, from our good friend Robert in Japan. And it came in just in this is the sort of thing that happens just in the nick of time. Because I had been silently wondering, what must this all look like from the outside? Commenting on the police attack, the chemical weapons attack by the police at UC Davis, Robert said, "I can't ever imagine this happening in my university here in Japan. Japanese people are too polite. I also think that the police would have a problem in hurting Japanese citizens. Then again, we just don't have the inequality here that would cause this problem, although the corporations are trying, moving lots of factories overseas due to the high yen. But that is not working out so well in Thailand. All of those factories are flooded. I wonder, Bob, how many times that they will have to learn this lesson? I mean, how many years of flooding in Thailand will have them realize that this was not such a good idea? How much money was wasted on this outsourcing, too? Another testimony to the stupidity of corporations everywhere, not to mention the latest scandal here with Olympus, the camera maker, which was busted due to a foreigner CEO who exposed the corporation. He had to flee Japan as the real criminals were trying to smear him. The corporation was buying company after company, using those assets to show higher levels of profits that in the end did not ever exist. Olympus, as a result, may be delisted from the stock exchange, yet it seems that every corporation here and everywhere has this same problem. Nomura, an investment company, did the same thing in the 1990s, using the little stockholder to pay for the losses of their rich ones. Citibank, again, has been busted here for doing the opposite, robbing their rich clients to boost their own profits. Sick, sick, sick. Robert says, "I call this," and I'm creating a new verb here, "Syriaization." The U.S. is becoming like Syria. And I followed up just telling Robert I appreciated, I appreciated his sharing. And said that I figured that from his perspective, it must simply look like craziness over here. Robert responded saying, yeah, the 85 odd pictures from the Washington Post, a link that he sent along, was like a tidal wave of horror. And to think that the collapse has barely begun. Just wait until the real show begins and the euro collapses and the dollar collapses. Why, this will be like child's play. Glad I'm over here, as I think I would be really participating in the demonstrations. I would not play nice. But that's the problem. Even if you get rid of 100 cop thugs, they are easily replaced with another 100 or 200, which are even worse. I'm also not surprised by the second revolution in Egypt. I was actually expecting it, but they, like us, will have to get rid of the military-industrial complex, which is sucking down 20% of our lives. Without that gone, nothing will change. I once detailed that this would involve the U.S. eliminating the Navy, Army, Air Force, CIA, and then other 19 secret organizations. I was laughed at and told it would be impossible. I can't imagine how this plays out, says Robert, but I think that the collapse will at least end mountaintop removal and possibly free trade, as at least no one will have money. He said, yes, we had one OWS protest in Tokyo, but it only involved 300 people, no tear gas, and no pepper spray. Thank you, Robert. Thank you for your comments. This in from Scott in Sweden, and I think it's important because it puts a little bit of context to what something that we talked about earlier. Scott listens in delay, and well, he's been busy. He, his dog, and his lovely wife have been busy searching for the elusive Nordic chanterelle. I looked it up when he mentioned it, and it sounds just yummy. I mean, really yummy. And so that's kept him sort of behind some shows a little bit. So Scott heard the discussion between Sandra and me about the guy who got up in the European Parliament and delivered a broadside against it. He says, I'm still on last week's shows, but that rant by Nigel Farage, nobody named Smith anymore in the world, about Europe being run by Germany as if it were the new Nazi state was more than a bit over the top. While I agree that the replacement of Papandreou and Berlusconi with bankers is very bad, this rant was filled with more cheap shots than is healthy. Instead of a Churchill, I heard a deeply conservative Brit longing for the fjords of the British, not German, empire. Yeah, it's pining for the fjords. Farage is a, what else, libertarian mole who burrowed himself into the EU Parliament for the perks, who left Thatcher's Conservative Party because it was too liberal. Oh, jeebus. He's fringe, albeit not one from Surrey. You get that one? That was, yeah. Surrey with the fringe on top? Yeah. He's fringe, albeit not one from Surrey. In short, he is the very same sort of wingnut routinely exposed on your show. A little background. He ran his own commodity broker until 2002. He was part of the great recent EU perk scandal at taxpayer expense. Hell, just read his entry in Wikipedia. Put his name in, followed by scandal in the web, and enjoy. He's associated with all sorts of EU wingnut, racist, homophobic, separatist parties, and he apparently wants what all libertarians want, destroy government, get rid of regulation. And if bashing Germany in a populist de jure works now, he'll be back bashing other government in whatever other disguise serves the day's purpose later. The Guardian calls him an evil genius. The British National Party, Reed Skinhead, denounces him for attempting to steal the British National Party's thunder over the free trade agreement with India, after being on the opposite side of the issue just weeks before. Is anything about this guy sounding familiar? If this guy is Churchill, then Newt Gingrich is FDR. Well, I do beg to differ on that point, Scott, simply because what you just described is Churchill. Churchill jumped from party to party to party, one step ahead of the trends, always happy to take credit for somebody else's work, but had a knack for saying things that sounded right to the ears of people at just the right times. Lord knows Churchill wanted women's suffrage advocates, marchers, whatever, wanted them locked up, beaten if possible. Churchill was an imperialist to the day he died at a ripe old age, mourning the loss of Inja. Now, in Inja's sunny clime, where I used to spend my time as servant of Her Majesty the Queen, of all them black-faced crew, the finest man I knew was our regimental bestie, Gunga Din. Yeah. Didn't want... Despised Mohandas K. Gandhi. So he may not be as far from Mr. Farage, whatever, as you think. Just because, not because of who Farage is, but because of who Churchill was. Scott continues, while I understand that Germany's name will remain tarnished for all the same reasons as Attila the Huns, it still does not mean that those in office today and behind the scenes must be resurrected Frankensteins. Don't forget that there really is a strong social democratic tradition, too, and that it is still fighting the good fight and doing it more successfully than what the U.S. progressives have achieved in our lifetime. They have worked hard to resist deindustrialization and outsourcing. So can we avoid jumping to the scariest conclusion just because Germany's name is mentioned? Forget calling Dr. Freud to the courtesy phone. This one is for Dr. Pavlov. The obvious association is not necessarily that most realistic association. And since you don't accept a Ron Paul slant on the state of the world when it hits the web, why accept Farage's, except that he managed to land his sneak jab at our soft spot, that touchy, spooky post-1930s hangover spot, and provoked the reaction he was hoping for. Compared, and this is important because this is from somebody who lived in America, grew up American, and went and moved away and has a perspective, like Roberts in Japan, that you and I can't have. So, listen up. Compared to Southern Europe, Northern Europe, including Germany and the Netherlands, the Nordic countries are solvent, much less corrupt, more tax-paying compliant, and so forth. It's not like all of the EU is in financial meltdown, but as Sandra pointed out, it's basically the old Latin and Greek fascist states where finances are worst. And, in my humble opinion, this seems to be just as related to traditions of corruption predating the 1920s. Let's not attribute all the mess to the recent horrible ideologies just because it's the tender spot we fear most. Historically speaking, it is worth remembering that Mussolini had been in power for way over a decade before Hitler came to power in his own right, but Hitler gets all the press, right? People who go to Rome and like to wander through the ruins of the Forum and so forth, they only do that because Mussolini's building programs unearthed it. It wasn't there. It wasn't visible before. Yeah, the Colosseum was standing there. Yeah, the Pantheon, sure, out on what had been the Campus Martius. But all those busted columns and stuff laying around, and the Via Sacra, that was Mussolini and his brown shirts, bunch of thugs. Dreaming imperial dreams for fully a decade before Hitler grabbed power in Germany. Scott continues, the social welfare systems work reasonably well up north being Northern Europe, where the population generally complies with its role as funder of the system, and not so well down south where tax evasion is a tradition. But trying to cash in on the benefits is also a part of the game, from cabbie to capo. Nicely done, Scott. And is this not a bit like the U.S. problem? Poor, unfair tax policies putting too much strain on the system, thereby opening the cluckhouse doors to the predators? Now, again, please don't think I'm saying that tax evasion is the sole cause. There is no sole cause. It's a multivariate mess. Still, if we have to go villain shopping, instead of the Fourth or Fifth Reich, what seems to be truly undercutting the EU welfare state's ability, viability, is that same old, good old friends, the giant private corporations moving the better-paying jobs to sweatshop countries and seeking to privatize all the common space. The tax base is eroding. And while it is true that the banksters helped the many crises along via shady dealing with the southern European economies, there's lots of blame here to share for the mess we're in, and that rot is not equally deep everywhere. Nonetheless, I agree with y'all, and even that stopped clock Nigel Farage, that putting those foxes in charge of the henhouse union is wrong. Hell, I'd call it a page out of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, just not the underhanded daring do of a secret German imperialist cabal finally realizing the Fourth Reich. Not as I see it. International capital doesn't give a hail hoot about nationality, but they do love them some money and power. Oh, I think we've got an early toaster nomination tonight. International capital doesn't give a hail hoot about nationality, but they do love money and power. So in closing, Scott says, let's not make a Churchill out of a mole. You always... Wow. When Scott sits down to write one for... And Sandra writing in, she says, I did qualify. I did say in the conversation that the dude was dubious. And yes, you did. I remember that specifically. And he is. But of course, I'll be interested to see Scott, to read Scott's response a little bit later after he hears last night's More and Monday show, in which we discussed this plan leaked from the German Foreign Office suggesting that, well, go back and listen to the show. You were here probably anyway. You know what I'm talking about. Wow. What a start. What a start for the evening. And then one other from the mailbag, right before showtime. Mike writing, stuck in the dreadful red state of Texas. God get me out of this periistic pablum puke piece of poo they call a republic. Mike writes, I don't know where you got your information from on pepper spray. Whether you use a 3-ounce can of Saber Red MK4 Crossfire, $11 online, or a 12-ounce can of Defense Technologies MK9 Red Band, White Band, or Blue Band, $75 online, it's all the same. Capsaicinoids. Ranging from 0.2% to 1.35% in strength, which 1.35% being the maximum level of intensity, regardless if used by the military, frontline police, or purchased on the internet by Bubba in the Hills, etc., anywhere in the world. This in response to my referencing of military-grade pepper spray. New Zealand, Mike says, I believe, requires the public to have a permit to purchase the stuff. There are probably other countries around the globe that have the same, but not the USA. Luckily, the cops didn't use pepper spray projectiles on those kids at UC Davis. Fired from a paintball gun, it could have injured, maimed, or killed one of them. Ever get hit by a paintball from a paintball gun? As a matter of fact, I have. It sucks. That's why I don't play paintball. It ain't funny and it stings. Mike says, I couldn't imagine being hit by a canister. Oh, and please stop sounding like Alex Jones and his stupid conspiracies. I need a little help, Mike. What conspiracy was that? We try to stay the hell away from them. Anyway, take care, Bob. Love your show and love Rick Smith's show, too. I try never to miss one. You are talk radio, buddy. the absolute best on the band waves, microwaves, airwaves, ocean waves, even the stadium wave. I'll say one thing for technology. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord, for allowing me to stream these two programs on my phone. Take care, and have a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving. Very respectfully, Mike. Thank you, Mike. Thank you very kindly. I appreciate, we all appreciate hearing from you. Where the information came from that that was military-grade pepper spray that was supposed to be used at a maximum or a minimum distance of 15 feet was from an interview with one of the young people who was pepper sprayed. And it wasn't commentary from someone who was simply opining about it. You can see that the stuff, I mean, you can see when the guy's hosing them down, that it's got one of those ranges like Raid Hornet spray, that it puts the stuff out in a stream at a great distance so that you don't have to be right on top of folks to use it. But the thug at the University of California, Davis, who, by the way, is, I was subsequently informed, on paid administrative leave. In other words, he's gotten free off time. He's being paid by the people of the state of California to cool his heels for a few days. Yeah, while an investigation is pending. Linda P.B. Katehi, the chancellor of UC Davis, addressed the students. She says she ain't going nowhere. I reiterate the fact that that woman has to be fired, and I'm relying on an email I received last night. She has to be fired, not resigned. She has to be fired so that she doesn't walk away with a cool $100,000 in relocation cash. Isn't it funny how the 1% gets stuff like relocation allowances that are equal to a quarter of their salary? $100,000 if she just walks away and quits. How many of you have jobs where if you simply quit your job, you get a quarter of your salary for relocation allowance? Anybody? Anybody? No, me neither. David Main writing in, who and he was the one who sent the Norman B. Smith story, who is not named Norman B. Jobs. The very fact that this matters for medical procedure is proof positive our medical establishment endorses paranoia about cannabis once again. I'm not calling it medical, just plain old marijuana. This reeks of this being connected to the Holy Prophet. What a travesty this is for, of all places, to be happening not just in America, but California. The prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, is rolling in his celestial field of consciousness. Notice I didn't say grave, says David in Maine, because Bill isn't in his grave, man. Exactly. Exactly. It has been a busy day on the email box. And I appreciate all the input, especially after a very busy show like what we had last night. Lots of stuff to be gone into. And lots of stuff yet remaining. Among other things, it being Tuesday, we have the Green News Report coming up, something to which I always look forward, as do, I hope, you, the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. We will take our top-of-the-hour break. I have filibobstered long enough. And we'll open up the phones for your thoughts and your comments. And this is not even the tip of the iceberg. Not even. Kind of frustrates me that we get this huge, huge, huge rash of stories on a week that's only 3 days long, because Thanksgiving and the day after. And we will not be broadcasting on Thanksgiving or the day after. I'm going to cook like a crazy man on Thanksgiving Day, and then I'm going to completely anesthetize myself with turkey sandwiches on Friday. What is it? The tryptophan. That's what's in the turkey, right? Yeah, it's the stuff that just knocks your ass out right after lunch. Well, I'm going to hang on for dear life, because for the first time in probably a generation, the Thanksgiving Day football game coming from Detroit is going to mean something. Man, it's going to be the Lions and the Packers, and it should. I hope it's a good game. No runaways on either side. It'll sort of battle back against the tryptophan, right? Yeah. So that's where we stand for the evening, and that's where from whence we go forward. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. Another $15 and another $25 have come in toward meeting Susan's challenge for this evening. Thank you very kindly. Hopefully I can announce in short order that the challenge has been met. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, November 22nd, 2011.
What we are seeing today is residual oil slowly coming to surface.
Meet the world's newest oil spill, now in Brazil and starring Chevron.
There are still too many Republicans in Congress who have refused to listen to the voices of reason and compromise.
Super committee fail, a win for big oil. Confirmed again, extreme weather is the new normal. Bye-bye oysters, plus... surprise! Fox News deceives its viewers about climate change.
So we asked you in the one burning question today about all this, whether it's a real threat or an attack on capitalism.
Or, the more you watch Fox, the less you know.
Many of you say, attack on capitalism.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Senator Rand Paul proposing that it's possible that maybe power plant emissions cure asthma.
I knew those coal plants are good for you.
Think of the implications for medicine. Feeling sick? Suck a tailpipe.
Delicious.
Quick side note, it turns out that Senator Paul's biggest donor is the delicious, delicious coal industry.
Who could have seen that coming? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, as the world continues to turn upside down, what details do you have for us today on all the madness?
Well, meet the world's newest oil spill, now off the coast of Brazil. Now tell me if this sounds familiar. Brazil will impose fines of upwards of $56 million on Chevron and rig owner Transocean for a deep water oil leak off of Brazil's Atlantic coast that's estimated to have spilled over 100,000 gallons of crude oil. George Buck, the American director of Chevron's Brazilian subsidiary, has promised to clean up the spill.
We will work with the government authorities for lessons learned to ensure that this does not happen in Brazil again.
Ah, good. Well, it'll never happen again.
At least not in Brazil. In the U.S., the failure of the Congressional Supercommittee is good news for the oil industry. On Monday, President Obama criticized congressional Republicans for rejecting a balanced approach to reducing the deficit that included raising taxes. The failure to reach a deficit deal means that $4 billion in annual permanent taxpayer subsidies to the oil industry will remain.
Oh, thank goodness.
The oil industry, the most profitable industry in the history of mankind, receives nearly four times the subsidies and tax breaks than the renewable energy industry receives.
I thought the Republicans didn't want the government to be picking winners and losers.
They have to be the right kind of winners and losers.
I see.
Bad news for oysters and other things with shells. Researchers say ocean acidification is the cause of a crash in oyster populations in the Pacific Northwest. The ocean naturally absorbs some of the carbon dioxide that humans emit from burning fossil fuels, but high concentrations of carbon dioxide in seawater trigger a chemical reaction that disrupts shell formation for many species in the early stages of development. No shell, no oysters. Higher carbon dioxide emissions also mean that the rash of extreme weather around the world will get worse and become the new normal. That's the conclusion of the latest summary of climate change science from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, released in advance of the latest round of international climate negotiations that are scheduled to begin next week. The IPCC says that unless emissions are cut, it is, quote, very likely that extreme weather events like severe droughts and record floods floods that used to happen once in a generation could occur as often as every other year by the end of the century. Finally, where will you hear the most coverage of climate change?
Right here on the Green News Report?
Well, yes, that. But on TV, you'll hear it on Fox News.
Well, that's great. I had no idea.
Ah, but you won't hear the science, just the spin.
I see. The made-up stuff.
Yes, a new academic study shows that of the three major cable networks over a two-year period, Fox News covered climate change far more than CNN or MSNBC combined.
That's great news.
And Fox's coverage was dominated by denial of the science.
Oh, not so good, but hardly a surprise.
Another study shows that Fox News viewers are less informed than people who don't watch any news at all. So turn off your TV, and already you're smarter than a diehard Fox News viewer.
Carbon dioxide is basically this. Look how much pollution I just put out.
And share that with your misinformed right-wing brother-in-law over Thanksgiving dinner this week. Speaking of, we'll see you after the holidays. Until then, for more on today's stories and all of the other ones we did not get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help support the Green News Report, including a new book, Richard Averitt's Imagine Politique, in which I, Brad Friedman, actually appear as a fictional character. No kidding. Check it out. It's an explosive political thriller, and it's a lot of fun. Check it out at greennews.bradblog.com. Until then, happy Thanksgiving to all. We'll see you next week. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Gobble, gobble.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got your bath and body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
You know, I confess to being a little bit dumbstruck by the fact that we're 2 days from Thanksgiving. How did this happen? That means we're just weeks away from the terrors of Christmas. And apparently the right wing's laying in the weeds. They've got some war on Christmas going on out there, but my God, they must be holding back for the big push. Ugh. Then again, I don't know, maybe they're just laying back because they know they've already ruined Christmas for so many people. I was in the store last night. We won't mention which one. It's the store. And I actually, not last night, yesterday, and I actually had a lady wish me happy holidays after I wished her happy Thanksgiving. Just a random shopper, a random consumer here in the advanced capitalist free market miracle that is America. Had no idea who she was or anything like that, but somewhere along the way it seemed appropriate to wish her a happy Thanksgiving, and I did. And she responded with, "And happy holidays to you." And I swear to Pete, I almost ran up and hugged her and thanked her for wishing me happy holidays. Just, ma'am, on behalf of the Jews, the Muslims, the atheists, the animists, the Wiccans, and everybody else who isn't all wrapped up in that Christian mysticism, thank you. And personally, thank you. I just want to hug you. Oh. So, I had an email from I was talking about being plopped out eating turkey sandwiches on Friday. And yes, there will be an orgy of college football Friday. Among other things, what will likely be the very last incarnation of one of the oldest rivalries in college football will happen Friday, when my West Virginia Mountaineers will rub their magic 350-pound blood-soaked lump of coal and take the field against the University of Pittsburgh, a rivalry that literally began when the teams would go to and from each other's home fields by barge. No kidding. Up and down the Monongahela River. Why does the Monongahela River flow north? Pittsburgh sucks. We tell that joke there on the campus of Harvard on the Mon, West Virginia University. Of course, it's not true because we're like, Morgantown is like Pittsburgh's little itsy-bitsy baby sister. And WVU students love Pittsburgh. It's a fun place to go. Many are the nights. But anyway, no, we'll see the end of that. We'll see that the end of that rivalry as Pittsburgh jumps to the ACC and West Virginia jumps incomprehensibly to the Big 12. God, I can't wait to go on a road trip and see Waco. No offense, but Waco? Really? We used to be in a conference where we'd get a trip to Miami every other year. That was nice to be a Mountaineer fan then. But it's gone. 100-plus years of tradition is gone. Fantastic finishes, an amazing history, gone. Why? Shh, the 1%! We don't even get to enjoy natural, native, good-natured, sometimes not, rivalries anymore because the 1% says that there's more money to be had in seeing West Virginia instead of on the Friday after Thanksgiving either going to Pittsburgh or hosting the Panthers there at home. Instead of that, oh, hell no. No, we're going to go to Lubbock. Or Stillwater. Or Houston. Not that I'm sure those aren't just wonderful places, but we don't have 100 years of history with it. But the 1% profiteers say that that's what we've got to do if we want to be continue to be considered relevant. Oh, no, Marty. I was already thinking about the Branch Davidians when I said Waco. And there's Fort Worth, which is almost like Dallas, and TCU, and golly, well, we could. No, who wouldn't want to go party in Norman, Oklahoma? Sorry, we've got listeners at the University of Oklahoma. I'm not trying to be an ass. I'm sure that there's not just a hell of a lot of fun to be had, but most people say, oh, going to Morgantown, West Virginia? What the? Because the entire Big 12's got to be said. We're going to go where to play who? But that's what I'll be doing on Friday. And when I mentioned that, I got an email in from Marty saying, you mean you won't be broadcasting live at midnight into Black Friday? From the Target? Yeah, Target employees are required to be at work by 11 p.m. on Thanksgiving night. Target, as Marty notes, what I used to call the not-as-bad big box store. Oh, yes, it is. Oh, yes, it is. And by the way, yes, an update on the challenge from Susan. Thank you very kindly. Let me see here. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Jay and Barb. Thank you, Robert. Let's see that. We're almost there. We are almost there. We are $15 away from meeting Susan's challenge. That's inspiring. 14 minutes past the hour. Like I said, it's a shortened week, and that kind of blows my mind. But we are not without stuff to talk about tonight, and we won't be without it tomorrow. I'm hanging on to some prayer meeting Wednesday goodness. And, of course, tomorrow night is also something special since it's the night before Thanksgiving. We have the annual telling of Bob and Agnes's night before Thanksgiving grocery shopping horror story. If for no other reason than if you go back to every program that was the night before Thanksgiving in the history of this attempt at broadcasting, I think you'll hear that story. And it gets a little better every year because with anybody who's aging, my memory improves and you remember little things. So that'll close out the program tomorrow night, I suppose. Or maybe we'll start the program with it. Anyway. Now, you know the number if you want to get involved with the program, if you want to speak your piece. Toll free, and by the way, the toll free number may be on the way out. I'm getting emails saying, hey, Bob, ditch the toll free. Everybody's got national long distance on their cell phones now. Ditch the toll free. If that's what it takes to keep the horn on the air versus going bye-bye, for God's sakes, get rid of the toll-free number. So that may be coming. But for now, if you want to reach the program, there are a multitude of ways to do it. You can email Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. You can participate in the chat room, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom. The back door appeared to be working fine. We've got a nice crowd in there this evening. But new folks are always more than welcome. And, of course, you can call the program. And the toll-free number is 877-4, H-E-A-D-O-N, 4 head-on, which translates to 877-443-2366. And then, of course, you can save us the toll charge of some few cents per minute, whatever it is, by dialing area code 304-658-3333. Okey-doke. So that's how you do that. Now, going back to a couple of different things, I guess you heard on the Green News Report that Rand Paul, a libertarian ophthalmologist's number one contributor, is, of course, those fine folks who are poisoning thousands of Americans every day and killing something on the order of 37,500 of them, not to mention the actual 1,000 who die of direct black lung exposure every year, the coal industry. Aren't they wonderful? Doesn't it just give you a warm, fuzzy feeling when you think about them out there helping little children learn how to use asthma inhalers? Doesn't it? Yeah. Well, I've been sitting on this story for a couple of days because I wanted to get to it at a point in time where there was sort of all the space around it needed to consider it in its totality. Because this is important. You may recall that we all briefly said, yay, hooray, the other day when President Obama said that he was not going to sign the necessary paperwork to send the Keystone XL pipeline forward until after the election. Now, he didn't say it that way. He said he had put off his decision until after the election. But in my little realist's world, that sounded like I'm going to wait till after the election before I sign it. Yes, I'm a cynic. I know. But cynics are made, not born. And I've kind of been down this road. But we were all happy to see that filthy, filthy, filthy pipeline wouldn't be going forward, because after all, one of the chief reasons for despising it lies in the fact that it is an environmental, that is to say, human welfare nightmare. That it's going to help cook the planet even more than we're already. It'll just turn the heat up a little notch or two. Right? Yeah. So if only temporarily we do one of these, whew, and it feels like victory, that's great, because we need victories. And Bill McKibben was very happy, and I'm very happy for Bill McKibben. the gravity of the harm, the degree and depth of the harm likely to be caused by the Keystone XL pipeline was monumentally monstrous. It was touted as one of the greatest potential eco-disasters in the offing. But I'm not telling you anything you don't know. Because you do know that, right? Thought so. Okay, so what? So this. And I don't bring you this information because I sense this as some sort of a competition. I don't. But there are horrors out there, and there are horrors. If you want to read this for yourself, I encourage you to go to Sightline Daily. And that's Sightline, Sightline.org. When I first saw my old pal Rory put this up on an email list last week, I shook my head, rubbed my eyes, because it sounded like, no, this can't be. Wait, oh. But it is. Sightline Daily is news and views for a sustainable Northwest. The article is by a gentleman by the name of Eric Duplass. It's dated November 16th. That's how long I've been sitting on it, because I wanted it, like I said, to have its own space. This is that space. Headline. And in a way, it's kind of a sit-down moment. Because we were told so much about how much harm would come from the Keystone XL pipeline, that this almost has an air of, no, wait a minute, about it. Headline, coal exports are bigger threat than tar sands pipeline. Let me read that again. Coal exports are bigger threat than tar sands pipeline. A carbon comparison of Northwest coal plans and Keystone XL project. It's got a big, plain bar graph. Which climate catastrophe is worse? And it is measured between Northwest coal exports and XL oil pipeline. Millions of tons of CO2 per year between the two. Eric Duplass writes, the planned Keystone XL oil pipeline has earned major national attention for the damage it would do to the climate. At the same time, another climate drama is playing out with much less attention as coal companies make plans to export huge quantities of coal to Asia by way of Pacific Northwest ports. See, this is just Northwestern coal. This isn't even mountaintop removal coal. This isn't coal from the Illinois Basin or Little Egypt where my good friend and spiritual brother Jeff Biggers lives. This isn't that. It's pretty clear that both projects are environmental horror stories, but I've been wondering, which one is worse? So from the King Kong versus Godzilla files, here's my analysis of their carbon impacts. It turns out coal exports are actually the bigger problem, and that's really saying something. Eric Duplass continues, the result surprised me. Coal exports look to be an even bigger climate disaster than the pipeline. There are, in fact, quite a bit more direct emissions from burning the coal than from the oil. And for me, I guess that stands to reason because it's just unknown. There's no way around it. Coal is the single filthiest hydrocarbon fuel on the planet. Period. There's no debate. They can talk about clean coal all they want, but you and I both know that clean coal is a dirty lie. It's an advertising slogan. It's a marketing gimmick. So to go back, Eric DePlas says, the results surprise me. Coal exports look to be an even bigger climate disaster than the pipeline. There are, in fact, quite a bit more direct emissions from burning the coal than from the oil. That's true even when one counts the energy-intensive tar sands extraction and processing. And, of course, there are plenty of upstream emissions associated with coal mining that I've left out of the equation here. In order to make a roughly direct comparison, I also omitted emissions associated with both products, mining, refining, transportation, and so forth. Clearly, we can ill afford either one of these projects. But until we have a clear energy policy that respects climate science, we'll be wrestling with these kind of killer projects one at a time. Guess what? That means we're going to be wrestling with these problems one at a time, because the government of the United States of America is quite possibly irretrievably broken. Need I remind you that we had majorities in the House, and not so much, but a majority in the Senate, and couldn't get climate legislation through. And we couldn't get climate legislation through. You know, they managed to pass that weak-kneed, sort of pathetic Waxman-Markey thing through the House. And it was like watching a regular human woman give birth to a 50-foot baby. It was awful and painful and a lot of noise and a lot of destruction. They managed to get that through the House, but in the Senate, dead. You know who helped kill it in the Senate? Democrats. Your Ben Nelsons, your Blanche Mansions, your Jay Rockefellers. Yeah, they killed it. Not Republicans. It's not always a Republican's fault. Oh, they were there to provide the biggest majority, but when it came time to count votes and see why it was that the Senate could not pass Waxman-Markey, the answer was because of people like Blanche Mansion, who was at the time governor and raising hell here, and various and sundry other coal-fired Democrats. Understand that plainly. So we're going to be wrestling, as Eric DePlas says, with these kinds of killer projects one at a time for a long time. Maybe forever. Because I'm very close to saying that the government of the United States has failed. Because even if we had Democratic majorities in both houses, the coal lobby is Democrat. For a number of Democrats, the coal lobby is their answer to Grover Norquist. It's the truth. Now, here are some of the numbers, and let's not get lost in the weeds, but just so you can see how conservatively Mr. DePlas was making these estimates, we'll go through it. To calculate the carbon dioxide emissions from coal exports, I assumed that 110 million tons of Powder River Basin coal are exported each year. That's consistent with the 50 million tons planned for Cherry Point, Washington, and 60 million tons planned for Longview, Washington. It's a figure that may actually understate the actual volume of exports, because the Longview project sponsors have already been caught out using an 80 million ton figure. There are nascent or rumored coal export plans that I didn't account for in places like Grays Harbor, Washington, St. Helens, Oregon, and Coos Bay, Oregon. Coos, I screwed it up. And if it's Coos Bay, I apologize. I further assume that Powder River Basin coal generates 8,500 BTUs per pound, and that 1 million BTUs would produce 212.7 pounds of CO2, consistent with U.S. Department of Energy figures. Do all the algebra, and you arrive... Not algebra! and you arrive at 199 million tons of carbon dioxide per year in direct emissions from the coal exports. And that is just Powder River Basin coal. Understand that even as we speak, they are desperately trying to start dragging wet, damn near carboniferous mud out from under the earth in Alaska, because they say that the coal reserves up there are greater than any coal reserves anywhere in the lower 48 states or North America generally. Coal keeps the lights on, Bob. Where? Harbin, China? Yes! And it's not because I've got a problem with the Chinese. I don't. Not the Chinese people. And it's kind of racist as a white guy for me to say, well, you know, we burned a lot of it, and no, China, India, you can't. Even as an Indian coal company destroys the very place where I live, there's something in the back of my mind that says, maybe we had it coming. Not me. Not my lovely little family that I hold so dear. Not my friends, my neighbors, and my colleagues. But America, yes. Heir and child of the British Empire that used the Indian subcontinent for its own personal toilet for generations. Why shouldn't they get their shot at the brass ring? Now, that's a larger conversation, isn't it? What constitutes the brass ring and whether one wants a shot at it in the first place? Anybody remember the name Bhopal? Is it any wonder, then, that having done so much to that corner of the world, there might be a sense of, you know what, we're going to give you back a little bit of what you gave us. Bhopal, of course, created by Union Carbide, the single greatest industrial disaster in history. Up until the Bhopal disaster, the single greatest industrial disaster in the history of the world, was also brought to you by Union Carbide. It happened within miles of this place from which I broadcast now. It was called the Hawk's Nest Tunnel Disaster, in which thousands went to their deaths breathing silica dust until their lungs, in the dampness of their lungs, they finally turned into concrete. And the little town at the foot of the mountain I live on was referred to as the town of the living dead, in which Union Carbide at-will employees stumbled away from the tunnel to slowly drown in their own bodies. Black lung sort of turns a person's lungs into ash. Silicosis turns them into concrete. So, yeah, there's an element of, I had this coming. But this is now, and I'm me, and we are we, and we're not going to go down without a fight. And we will keep fighting with everything that's left in us. But this report serves as how much play has it gotten? How much coverage has it gotten? Have you seen any coverage of this report in the 1% for-profit media? Any of it. Really, I'd like to be proven wrong. Honest to Jesus, I would. This is your fight if you live in the Northwest. If you do not want everything that you hold dear about the place where you live . Better get in this fight. You better get in this struggle. because the coal industry kills, poisons, and destroys everything it touches, and it does so in the name of a tiny handful of vicious thug profiteers. And believe you me, if they can't get you to give them what they want in St. Helens, Oregon, if they can't get you to give them what they want in Grays Harbor, Washington, in Longview, Washington, in Cherry Point, Washington, if they cannot get you to give them what they want, they will steal it from you. I don't suppose we have the time this evening for me to do a master class on a nasty little piece of work called the broad form deed. But it is how this state and huge swaths of Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee came to no longer be in the hands of the people who fought and bled and died to settle it, but instead became concentrated in the hands of what are called land companies. I don't have time. But what's more important, in Longview, Washington, in Grays Harbor, Washington, in St. Helens, Oregon, Coos Bay, Oregon, you don't have time. You don't. You mobilize now. You mobilize with urgency. You mobilize with the understanding that a monster is bearing down on you that does not care whether you live or die as long as they make their profit. And all of this coal, I reiterate, is not going to run one light bulb in the United States of America. It is not going, not going to power one computer. It is not going to do a damned thing inside the United States of America except line the pockets of a very teensy, tiny, itsy, bitsy, ultra-toxic minority that is not going to live anywhere near Grays Harbor, Washington, or Longview, Washington. Nowhere near it. And they'll pay a handful of people to drive around. And hey, won't it be nice when you can't drive anywhere in Washington or Oregon without seeing some benighted, ignorant fool with a sticker on their car that says, Friends of Coal. Although I'm sure you won't pronounce it that way. You better mobilize. And that's the difference, you see. There's organizing. And you can organize, you can start organizing now, and you can still be organizing 25 years from now, 50 years from now. You can organize. And they will go over you like a steamroller over a paper cup. You mobilize. Mobilizing is what you do when the threat is imminent and the harm is almost incomprehensible. That is mobilization. You get out in the streets now. Go to Occupy Seattle. Go to Occupy Portland. Go to Occupy where the hell ever and take you a sign that says the 1% wants to kill us all with coal because, and I really can't put enough emphasis on this, they do! They mean your death as long as it yields them a tidy profit, some small portion of which they can give to senators like libertarian ophthalmologist Rand Paul and my own Blanche Manchin and Jay Rockefeller and Mitch McConnell and Bob Corker and Pat Toomey. And on and on and on. It's coming at you. And if you are concerned, and you should be, if you are concerned about the overall impacts of the burning of coal on this planet, remember, again, this is only talking about Northwest Coal. And just in considering Northwest Coal, the tar sands pipeline and the harm coming from it pales by comparison. That's not all the millions upon millions of tons that come from blasted mountain communities and dug from underneath the earth in Appalachia, where the water runs black and toxic. This is just Northwest Coal coming out of the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and the emerging fields in Montana. That's all. Taken in perspective, the tar sands pipeline is teensy tiny and itsy bitsy. You know, for all of the thug jackass that he has been with Occupy, Michael Bloomberg gave $50 million to the Sierra Club for what is called their Beyond Coal campaign. I suspect it's because Michael Bloomberg is not an idiot. And he realizes that, even though they don't like to admit it, the 1% have to admit they breathe the same air as you and I. Us 99% proles. And that air is filthy with the toxins that come from coal-fired power plants in the United States. The $50 million that Michael Bloomberg gave to the Sierra Club for its Beyond Coal campaign are geared toward making sure that we ultimately end the use of coal for the generation of electricity in the United States. Gosh, that sounds noble, doesn't it? That day in the future where everything is run on wind and solar because it's viable right now, no matter what the right wing and Radio Rwanda and Fox News and so forth say, that we can have a future that is coal-fired free on our electrical grid. Wind, solar, geothermal can carry the entire burden. It's inspiring, isn't it? There's only one problem with that. If you shut down right now, or 10 years from now, or 20, or 50, if you shut down every blessed coal-fired power plant in the United States, it will not end the ecological and human rights disaster that is coal production in the United States. It will not end the torment of the Powder River Basin of Wyoming. It will not end the torment of little mountain communities in Appalachia. It will not end the torment of the Diné people on the Black Mesa in Arizona. It will not end the degradation and dehumanization of communities in southern Illinois. It will not end any of it. It will not end longwall mining in Pennsylvania. It will not end it. Because the ravenous maw of advanced capitalism is jacked open wide like the gaping mouth of an anaconda that can swallow anything that gets put in it. And it wants coal. If we stop burning coal tomorrow or any time in the future, there will still be explosions in Appalachia and Wyoming and Arizona and Illinois and Pennsylvania and Alabama to drag that filthy, vile poison out of the earth and get it on a boat and send it to India and Russia and China. They're going hammer and tongs in Western Australia. They're moving into places like New South Wales because they can't get it out of the ground as fast as the Chinese want to consume it. But we're going to be beyond coal as long as there's no coal-fired filth in the air for the 1% to breathe. Is there any better example of 1% thinking than that campaign? Oh, let's end the coal-fired power plants so the 1% doesn't have, so little 1% babies don't have to learn how to use asthma inhalers. Never mind if we continue to cook the planet while they're constructing their little Logan's Run bubble cities. But I wanted you to have that story. And I wanted you to have it in a way that it would stand entirely by itself. Not in any way challenged by any other bit of information. I wanted it to be unmistakable, open and notorious and obvious. Because while we look at the birdie in the magician's right hand, he's slitting our throats with his left. It's just a fact. So this is that space, and that is the emphasis. And you're on notice, and I'm on notice. You know, when I think about what is headed for those communities in Washington and Oregon, my heart aches. And I yearn to be able to be out there just to maybe help get folks fired up and understand the very bottom line of all of this. And that is that the coal industry, more than anything else, exclusive to anything else, is a homicidal agency. Coal kills. It just does. It poisons everything it touches. Everything. And I think about the temperate rainforests of the Pacific Northwest, and I can't help but think about the temperate rainforest of Appalachia. I had to be out and about early today. And when I went out to the car, it was as if the entire world had been, overnight, had been transformed into a world that was monochromatic. This late autumn morning was done up in nothing but shades of gray. And the sky, like Shakespeare said, was literally lowered over our housetop. And in those instances, it's easy to go, bleh. But I pulled myself back a moment. And I took a breath. And I felt the wet in the air. The wet of coming rain. That some would say by now should be snow. And I looked at that monochrome landscape. I think I even took a picture. And
and I realized in a moment that although I have never been to the magical places of the American Northwest, that perhaps all along I've had an intimate knowledge of what it must be like. Because we too, we Appalachians and you Northwest people, you Washingtonians, you Oregonians, we're rainforest people. And those monochromatic landscapes are, in their own way, exquisitely beautiful. Driving down the mountain toward Charleston, we passed Gauley Bridge, that town of the living dead I mentioned a little bit ago, where the Great Kanawha, where the Great Kanawha River is formed by the junction of the Gauley and the New. And you can see the eddying swirls of filth in the Gauley as it pours into the New. And along the riverbanks, you could see accumulated chemical foams that had been ginned up that all come downstream from the coal operations up the Gauley. But across the face of that broad spot in the river, every bit of a mile across, steam rose from the face of the water, and a sheen was on the river, almost like ice, but not. And we followed that all the way down to Charleston. Layerings and shadings and nuances of gray. And a cloud cover so thick that you would not know that the sun even existed. And I had that dawning moment, and I knew I had to bring this story tonight. Because I don't want for you in your temperate rainforest what has been forced upon us here in ours. No, they won't blow your mountains up. They'll just poison all your water. And those little communities that I mentioned will not be fit places for human beings to live. And your communities will become infamous as the jumping-off points for vast shiploads of death. Because that is coal. Coal is death. Again, to read the study and get a better handle on the methodology, if you wish, go to sightline.org. Coal exports are a bigger threat than tar sands pipeline. And in a way, we didn't even scratch the surface of this. But for God's sakes, be on notice. No, not for God's sakes. For our sakes. For your sake. For the sake of yours as yet ungotten and unborn, for their sake. For their sake. We are in the midst of something. Jude alluded to it in her email. Robert
alluded to it in his. We are in the midst of something. Something aborning. There is a birth taking place. And we don't know what's going to be born. Out of the Occupy movement will come either a new dawn of humanity, or out of the jackbooted response to it will come the monster that will finish us off. It sounds pretty damn scary and grim, doesn't it? Here's the good news. Whether that monster is born, or whether that smiling face of that new humanity is born, is not up to the 1%. The good news is that choice is up to you. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Brock.
Well, you heard my old buddy B-Rez there. You know the number. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, Head On. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. I filled a mobster a good long while last night. I don't recall doing a two-hour filibuster in a while. But don't wait until the last 10 minutes of the program, and then we're going to do conversation radio. Just don't do that. It's frustrating for us both. Let's go to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What's up, Andy?
Not much. I don't know. You were doing a lot of filibustering, like you said.
I had to get that coal story out there.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about energy also. You know, if you heard, you know, you're not hearing this that much, but it's really kind of good news. In the Financial Times a few weeks ago, they had an article that in Germany, they had like 6 days in September where the wind power generated from their wind farms was much stronger than they ever expected, and they had to tell the coal-fired plants and the nuclear plants to shut down because the grid was becoming too overburdened with electricity.
Yeah, they had a wind energy spill.
Yeah, so I mean they're not even close. They're like only 1/4 of the build-out they want. I mean, they definitely don't need the nuclear plants and the carbon-based fossil fuel plants. If the wind energy is going to pick that up, and you know, once they get the whole storage situation under control, who needs nuclear and carbon fuel plants?
Nobody. I mean, is there? Yeah, I guess there are a few places on the planet where the air is particularly still. The doldrums of the between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn and the Atlantic, for instance. But there's not a lot of people that live there, Andy.
And then you were talking about the Northwest and the coal production there going to Asia. There was an article on November 5th in the New York Times. And again, it had to do with the same type of issue. The article is called Taming Unruly Wind. And again, in the Northwest, they have some wind farms with the, I think it's the Bonneville Power Administration. And they found, too, that the wind generation has been much stronger than they expected, and they're paying customers and retrofitting them with storage facilities in their water heaters and their space heaters so they can store the excess electricity generated from the wind power. And in June of 2010, they were generating so much wind power, this is even a year ago, that they told one of the nuclear power plants to cut its energy, electricity production by 80%. They didn't need it. The grid was too full.
Forgive me saying it, Andy, because I don't want to sound, I don't want to just sound giddy, but that makes, you know, when I read story, and I read the Europe story, you know, they were actually paying people to take electricity at that point.
Right.
I get all tingly.
The grid was just totally inundated, flush with electricity that they didn't need. I mean, we're, you know, I don't get it. I mean, if I were an investor and I were in the coal companies or into nuclear power, man, I would just be dumping that stuff like crazy. It's over. I mean, that, from what I'm seeing.
You would think so, yes. But let's do remember, and maybe it's my fault for not bringing this out. A whole bunch of those exports, whether it goes from those planned ports in the Pacific Northwest or whether it leaves Mobile or New Orleans or Norfolk, Virginia, the coal on those boats is going to places where they're burning it to make steel. Because our steel industry is dead in the United States, for all intents and purposes.
I think I was reading where that coal that's in the Northwest or in Alberta can't is coking coal.
Right, and coking coal is steel-making coal. But for power generation, yeah, it's just dumb. It's just dumb.
Right. But I think that's great news with the wind power. And that news isn't getting not getting out there. And just wait till they get the full bill.
Hey, Andy, I hate to say it, but can you stand by for just a minute? I've been called away from the microphone. I hate to do this, but I will be right back. I've never done this before, but can you do that, please?
Sure.
Stand by. Hey, Andy, I'm god-awful sorry about that, but out here in the country, when somebody in a cruiser shows up in your driveway, well, Agnes comes and gets me.
I hope everything's all right.
Oh, yeah, it is. They were looking, local constabulary, looking for a neighbor, which mercifully was not me.
That's good.
Yeah.
That always puts me in shock when a cruiser shows up.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm still waiting for, I'm waiting for my heartbeat to, you know, drop down below 200 beats a minute because, you know, you're going to the door and I didn't do anything.
I spent so much time around those Occupy places and I know they're filming me like crazy. I must have a dossier and file on me about a foot thick at the FBI or the Fed, you know, whatever.
Well, this is,
I'm just waiting. With all the violence that I've, you know, you see occurring on YouTube and that the kids are picking up, who knows? Right? No habeas corpus can do anything they want to you, man.
Yeah. And I think it was, I can't remember which correspondent it was at the beginning of the program that said, so what if 200 or 300 get fired? There's 200 or 300 more that want that job. And, you know, it was, I think, Mark in Florida noting on the program last night, that the cops on all these cops with all this pepper spray and all their clubs and everything, guess what? They're the beneficiaries of the work of Occupy because it's their, among other people, it's their jobs that Occupy is complaining about being
couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
Billy clubs.
Yeah.
Got them billy clubs.
Yeah, no, I will not say baton again because, you know, these are not the golden girls from LSU twirling on the 50-yard line.
These things are 3 foot, 4 foot friggin' long. These are not small. These are weapons. These are like baseball bats. They're like fungo bats, long fungo bats, the ones you can really whip around.
Yeah, you can simply put, kill somebody with one. I read the story the other day of...
Absolutely you can.
An individual with a busted spleen that was... kept not in the hospital, but in a jail cell.
Right, a Iraqi vet. They split his spleen.
Yeah.
If you get cracked over the head by one of those, it could easily crack your skull. No question. These things are heavy.
I wouldn't be surprised.
They like to clack them along the ground here in San Francisco. I've seen them. They bounce them off the ground, man. They're pretty intimidating.
Yeah, and that's exactly what that is. It's an intimidation factor.
Right. Matter of fact, I think I told you I was there Saturday night. They raided the camp at the Federal Reserve at 101 Market Street. I was there eating pizza with some of the guys, and then I drove away, and I heard on the news they were being raided, came back, the whole camp was gone. They had cleaned out the whole thing. About 20 tents and maybe 20, 30 people were out at the site in front of the Federal Reserve. Gone. And all the they said like 300 cops descended on the place, and maybe like say 20 or 30 of the kids and older people, too, camped out there. And then when I got there, it was already cleaned out within 45 minutes by the DPW, Department of Public Works, and there were maybe 40 or 50 cops left there. And I just walked up and walked along the line of those cops. And you know what? Quite frankly, when I did that, I don't think they wanted to be there. I really got that impression. I just looked at them, and they stared back, and I just was making this face like, do you guys know what you're doing? Why are you doing this? And they just, not, you know, didn't say a word to me. They just stared at me. It was like they were, didn't want to be there, you know? So a lot of that's too, you know, they're ordered to do, you know, I don't want to show any compassion for the police because I don't have too much after what I've seen what's going on, but I get the impression a lot of these guys, they don't want to be there. They don't want to be doing that at 2 a.m.
I can't imagine, you'd kind of have to have something severely wrong with your brain to want to.
Yeah. Because nobody's, you know, causing any problem. They're all they're doing is sleeping. They're making their home.
Yeah.
Nothing. No violence, you know, no...
Well, I don't know if you read the backstory to what happened at... I don't know if you read the backstory to what happened at Davis, Andy, but the day before...
I'm trying to keep up with it.
The day before this guy was...
near there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The day before this guy was hosing these kids down... they were feeding him. No. They were bringing him coffee and food.
What kills me is guys using industrial strength mace, which are supposed to be 15 feet away because of the force of that spray and the toxicity of the mixture it is, it's supposed to be a long-range spray that stays in the, that is in the air that you kind of breathe. It's not something you're supposed to spray directly into somebody's face, nose, or mouth, because they say it feels like your face is being ripped off.
Yes.
By those chemicals.
And I don't know
mouth?
I don't know if they do it with the officers out there, but it here in West Virginia, every officer that carries a can of that stuff is required before he's ever allowed to can it to carry it to have it used on him.
Wow.
And granted, under that situation, they're standing right there with him. They've got the water, they've got the cloths, they've got the stuff to get the oil base off the skin. But yeah, he has to, or she has to stand there and take a blast in the face.
Wow. Well, that might give you some empathy and sympathy for the person you're blowing away. But one thing that killed me is one of the girls that they evidently sprayed it right in the woman's mouth, and she was spitting up blood for like 45 minutes or something like that, and had, you know, severe problems at the hospital.
Yeah. I mean,
how awful. How awful. You talk about torture.
Yeah. It's a, and that's, you know, that's why I was so emphatic, Andy, about saying, you know, we can't call this pepper spray anymore. It is a chemical weapon attack.
No, it's not like throwing tomatoes at somebody.
No.
That's for sure. No, it's a lethal, toxic weapon. It's a toxic weapon. No question about it.
And
you know, something else you're talking about. Go ahead.
No, please.
I said you're talking about the environment. I haven't heard you talk about this, but do you know the U.S. is the number one opponent to these greenhouse gas carbon permits the EU is trying to get for the airlines?
Oh, yes.
And this John Mica, representative in Congress, is the guy really going to bat for the airline industry with the civil aviation organization of the U.S. so they don't have to pay the EU for their carbon fuels? You know, they're spewing all over the European environment because they can't make the standards that the EU wants them to have, so they have to pay extra fees for like a carbon tax.
Well, John Mica doesn't believe in global climate catastrophe in the first place.
Well, what pig in Congress does? That's why they have a 9% rating, right?
Well, I mean, there are some. I mean, in fact,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and beyond some, there are a good number who do. But
yeah, well,
this is the proof.
90 or so of the progressives.
Right, and this is proof.
Unfortunately, there are 530 Congress people. There.
Right. And you know what?
20 that are on our side.
You had that jackass from Alaska, Don Young, whose audio I ran last night.
Yeah, I heard it.
Yeah, now that guy does not believe in global climate catastrophe.
What does he have, an IQ of about 70?
I think you're being generous.
I think so too. What a moron! It's hard for me to believe. How does a guy like that ever get elected? Just like you said, how does a guy like that ever get elected? You know, what a total shill for the industry.
Well, I was going to say something else that begins with S-H-I, but no, shill will do.
Yeah. And I guess this guy Micah must be the same way. You're right, they don't believe in the whole climate. Well, now they're saying it's up to 380 carbon parts per million or something.
Right,
like
we're past 350.
We're going way beyond McKibben's 350 number. That's awful. And I think we don't have to be here. And, you know, as Albert says all the time and goes off, we don't have to be here, and we are. It's not necessary. We got the technology.
Yeah, this doesn't have to be our reality.
No, it doesn't at all. If the oil, I was reading today with the oil industry in the United States, their annual revenues is almost $1 trillion a year, all the oil companies together, like $982 billion or something in revenue. God, they got so much money to throw around. It's incredible. Now, how do you fight that? When you have unlimited cash, it is so difficult.
Yeah, the only answer to it is more people in the street.
Yeah. Well, we're trying.
Yeah, I think it's meeting with success.
Well, it's definitely, like they say, changing the conversation, which is great.
And you know, one of the important things about Occupy San Francisco and what's going on in Davis, and you know, these are so-called temperate climates, and so there's a greater chance of it hanging on through the brutal parts of winter, so that there is somewhere for it to reflower in the spring.
Right. It won't be the elements that tear people away from the camp. That's not a big problem.
No,
they need a sleeping bag. You know, they can do it with just blankets, a lot of the kids.
Yeah, and authority understands the nature of the problem. That's why they're confiscating without warrants, without anything. That's why they're confiscating winter-related items at Occupy Boston.
Right. Freeze them to death. If they don't kill us one way, they'll kill us another way with the elements. They're going to kill us all. It's damned if we do, damned if we don't. They'll kill us one way by taking our jobs away, taking our benefits, taking our food, or we can go out and fight them with the elements, and they'll take everything we have away there. Either way, we lose. I mean, the powers that be got to know our backs are to the wall. Damned if we do, damned if we don't.
I think they do, but that's got to give them pause for concern, doesn't it?
Oh, you got to believe it. You see, the Wall Street Journal came out, you know, this is the ultimate businessman's paper. U.S. firms eager to add foreign jobs. They redid the numbers from 2000 to 2009. We lost 2.9 million jobs were created by U.S. multinationals overseas. That's 2.9 million. And we had a net job loss of jobs here from that period, 2000 to 2009, 864,600 to be exact jobs, the new figures that came out. So great, they're creating jobs overseas. That does us a heck of a lot of good. Why are they even here? Why do they even benefit?
Well, because they
because headquarters here.
Well, Andy, because the 1% never wants to live where it defecates.
Yeah, they created 943,000 jobs in China, 453,000 in India. Get this, they created 529,000 in France, 614,000 in Germany, 1.1 million in the UK, 614,000 in Germany, 1.1 million in the UK, 505,000 in Brazil. I can go on. Canada, they even created a million jobs. Here we have jobs. We have a negative.
Of course, factors all with Andy that can't be ignored. Jobs in the UK, jobs in France, jobs in Germany, jobs in Canada. Guess what? A transnational business doesn't have to deal with in compensation packages there? Healthcare.
That's right. In a lot of those places, that's right. Germany and Canada and the UK, for sure. Any of the European countries. France, oh, yeah, definitely.
Right.
Isn't that amazing? And I don't understand why we never hear that as a great benefit to business. They don't have to jack around with employer-sponsored health care. They don't have to jerk around with that. That's all covered. It's all taking all the administrative costs, all of that. We don't have to worry about it.
And look at that, Germany.
I think what an advantage that would be for business.
Germany, France, Canada, the UK to one extent or another, those are all so-called social welfare states.
Yeah, and they're creating jobs by our multinationals.
Right.
It just kills me. I see those kids down at Occupy, and these kids should be working. You know, they should be supplied with jobs and training programs, and they're not. And yeah, a lot of them are vets, you know, and everything else. A lot of young kids, and man, they're just, I don't want to say they're wasting away down there because they're definitely having an impact, but they should be picked up by those multinationals and put to work. And they're not.
Right. And the fact of the matter is, I would like to see those jobs come along because, frankly, having been raised in it, I haven't lived in it in quite some time, but having been raised in it, the middle-class lifestyle is kind of nice.
It's better than sleeping on the streets, I'll tell you that, without having a shower or a bathroom.
Yeah.
And having to use porta-potties all day long.
Well, if you've got the weird kind of mindset that I do, there's a certain kind of pleasure in paying one's bills every month and getting something in return and knowing that that you can have an ambition, you know, for what, you know, for creature comforts, you know, a new car once in a while, or a washing machine, or a refrigerator, or a roof.
Right.
And none of those things are out in the future for these kids who are in the streets, and it's their realization that it isn't in their future that has them in the streets. I think there's a manifestation among some of them, is there not, Andy, that they would kind of like to have that? That they'd like to have jobs, that they'd like not to be crippled by debt when they're done with their education and be able to do something in their chosen field?
I've been talking to, you know, some of these folks, and you're exactly right. They've been out there, and a number of them have had jobs and either lost the jobs or they didn't really pan out the way they expected. And they kind of been disenchanted with the whole way it worked out. And they put in a lot, and some of them put in the time to go to college and put that time, and they just, their expectations were higher than what they got. And they tried, they went out there and they tried to pick up better jobs and to get ahead. And you know, because of this outsourcing garbage and because of bringing in H-1B visas and doing this garbage, they just don't have the opportunities. And it's a crime that they don't, and they should. But it's really criminal. And I know I've talked to some of these, and they're sharp people, and they've tried, they've been out there, they've been doing this for a couple of years, you know, bouncing around to different jobs or trying to move up in the field they really got trained for in college. And the openings, the opportunities just aren't there. And I guess after a couple of years of doing that, after knocking your head against the wall, you just go, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be, the Occupy movement is that better way if you've been knocking your head against the wall for a couple of years. And a lot of these kids have. They tried. You know, they got trained in a certain field. I thought the one guy the other night, he was in international studies. He knew a few foreign languages. I spoke to another guy that graduated from Cornell. And last I heard, that's an Ivy League school.
Yes.
And he's camping out at Occupy SF.
And it's not because he doesn't have anything better to do.
God, you go to Cornell, you must have been pretty well screened to even get in there.
Yeah, no, you don't get into Cornell on something you get in a gumball machine.
Right. He's a graduate?
But I, you know, I've seen much of the same thing, and I've been having some conversations, and I'm not, this is not about ego or anything, but I have come to the conclusion, based on what I've seen over the last few years, that whether people realize it or not, the seeds of Occupy first germinated here in Appalachia. Because that is where young people came who wanted to make a difference with their lives in a struggle that meant something way further and outside their individual beings. And when you talk about the qualifications of the young people that we've seen coming in to engage in the struggle against mountaintop removal, Andy, yeah, you're talking about people with physics degrees. You're talking about people with the mathematics degrees that understand concepts of advanced light, okay?
Right.
We're one of the great failings so far, and it's not a failing, we were just, you know, kind of up against the wall, is the fact that the for-profit 1% media have been allowed to characterize these young people as, so-called DFHs, dirty effing hippies. They're not.
If you listen to Peter King of New York, sure, that's exactly what you think. They're not. All these places have libraries. All these places collect books. The kids are reading books when they have the time.
Yeah.
They're reading.
Yeah, when the cops aren't throwing the books in the dumpster.
Right, when they're not burning them, like the Nazis.
Yeah.
The thing, too, have you heard this? Did you see that 60 Minutes piece about the insider trading? That blows my mind.
Oh, I did. Spencer Baucus should be in the town square getting rotten vegetables thrown at him.
Yeah.
Just
a lot of these folks should. This is such baloney.
Well, how could you? They live in what our buddy Jim occasionally refers to as the Forbidden City, and nothing is refused unto them. It's all just paperwork. As long as the paperwork looks okay, you can do whatever strikes your fancy.
It does amaze me of the unethics, the immorality, and they don't understand why can you do this, but somebody else not in Washington cannot do this. Why do you have this privilege to insider trade? You know, I saw there was a study out by some professor, now I can't remember his name, but it blew my mind, and this was done in 1994 to 1998. They looked at the records of the trades done by the people in Congress and the staffers, and they beat the average investor by 12%. I've got to tell you right there. I mean, that's a huge deviation.
Yeah, hey, I didn't tell you, but let me tell you. You know, a little phone call on the side, right.
Right. You have to have inside information. And even Nancy Pelosi, they nailed her in that 60 Minutes piece trading on Visa stock before some legislation didn't pass to really put the kibosh on some of the credit card fees that went through. And they nailed her, and she was real antagonistic back to the folks who questioned her about that, that she was misrepresented by the whole thing. No, it's pretty clear. You bought 4,000 shares of Visa right before the legislation was killed. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. Please.
But Spencer Baucus has now introduced legislation to stop congressional insider trading. You'll probably be pleased to hear that, Andy.
Well, I read an article, and now there was only a handful of people signed up. There's a Louise Slaughter bill to actually sign up to the bill, and now there are 46. And I think my friend told me there's actually 70 co-sponsors now, but I haven't actually verified that. But yeah, I think they're getting a little heat from people. When you put it on 60 Minutes, a lot of the word gets out. There's something that really rotten here. Really rotten.
And the nice thing is, you know, you get up around 200 co-sponsors, a little higher than that, I think, and you can do a discharge petition, and it goes right, it leaves it, no committee, just straight to the floor, up and down vote.
Right.
And you'd love to see something like that happen.
Yes, you would. And now's the time, while the iron's hot on the griddle. Let's get it out there.
Yeah.
Fire it up.
Exactly.
Let's get that vote. Now people are watching it.
And speaking of watching, I didn't even realize it, but I guess there's another one of these little Repiglican pageants on tonight.
Yeah, there is.
The national security discussion. That should be like a trip a trip through Wonderland.
Yeah, it'll be a trip down memory lane of the 1968 Chicago convention or something.
Well, how many times do you think they've said Ronald Reagan already, or maybe a reference to tear down this wall?
Now, we need law and order. We need the law and order candidates. Got to keep these kids in line.
After they get
one other thing.
Go ahead.
I was listening to Professor O'Neill and Lilly piece at the university with the Cordovia. Just offhand, I wasn't real happy they brought up Howard Zinn as being some lefty who makes up things in his book. And then the guy kept quoting Tom Friedman. I'm sorry, Bob. Anybody who quotes Tom Friedman maybe ought to have his head examined, because I haven't heard Tom Friedman say anything that has very little truth in it whatsoever. And everything Tom Friedman says, for the most part, is for the top 1% in the plutocracy. All their lies and
bullshit. I think Dr. Bill did a pretty good, you know, he did a pretty good job of getting outside whatever agenda Friedman may have had, and addressing the fact that we treat college like trade school, when that was never what it was meant to be.
Right. He was trying to make it as far as, I know that two-year study they did, that kids really aren't learning the critical thinking, but Thomas Friedman is looking at comparing it to India and saying we should all be entrepreneurs and kind of all be consultants and all be contractors. We're all in business for ourselves. And again, that is what the plutocracy and the top 1% want. They want to divide and conquer. They want us to all think we can all be millionaires and billionaires and start our own business and be entrepreneurs. And I'm sorry, that only happens to a very, very few. Most of us have to work in big organizations and have to use teamwork and the power of the many to survive in this marketplace. We all can't be entrepreneurs, and we all can't be contractors and have no benefits and no nothing like the Indian model. I think that's flawed,
and I think if you made inquiry of Dr. Bill, he would probably be in agreement with you. But the larger point that there is at least an interest in creating, for instance, access to technology among the poor of India, who are among the poorest of the poor in the world, the idea that there are people who have interest in that are within the so-called business class. Well, hell, you're not going to find that over here. You're not going to find anybody talking about making a $35 iPad.
Right.
Because the whole idea is to continue selling $700 iPads that cost $12 to produce, based on people who are being profoundly abused 7,000 miles away.
Right. Well, definitely lowering the cost and giving everybody the same capabilities over the net with that iPad example is a good thing. But what it does is it's up to easy. It just puts you at an equal playing field with technology. The problem, everybody has that. And like I said, it kind of up ante at work. Like everybody has a BlackBerry. Everybody has an iPhone. So everybody's on call all the time. Where the people you're going in India, you're in China, you always got to be going. You're never off. You're always on. There's no excuse.
Yeah, and that is
turned on. That's what kind of bugs me. It's upping the ante. It's upping the ante, and you just work and work and work.
No,
I have an advanced degree in computer science, Bob. The computer, the internet, all that stuff. It's a tool. It is a tool. It's not going to be your road to success per se. It's just putting you at even par with somebody else.
Right. It's sending you out onto the golf course with clubs in your bag as opposed to a hoe and a garden rake.
Right. Now at least you can compete, but it's no assurance that you're going to get the benefits that you might really deserve.
And within, the rise of the tablet and everything, within all of this, there are profound limitations. I mean, if you own an Apple product, and this is not a credit, you are limited to what Apple wants you to be able to see and do on the internet. Because for Apple will not run Flash. Apple will never run Flash.
Absolutely. They want to control the product as best they can, so you buy more of their product. Same thing with Microsoft. They want you to be in their little kingdom that they've created, their little environment. They don't want you getting out.
And look at the degree to which these other companies have run out there trying to proprietize. Jesus, is that even a word, Andy? What was originally designed to be an open source operating system in Android.
Right, and that's Google. Yeah, they want to control the environment as best they can, so you keep buying their product.
Exactly.
The whole game. All right, well, great talking to you, Bob. I don't want
to
take.
Good talking to you too, Andy. I apologize for the weird little interruption in the middle of our conversation.
Letter.
We're a dull moment around here. You can't just let them knock on the door because sometimes they come through.
No, you cannot. Not in this day and age. Have a great Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm going to have a great Thanksgiving too.
Okay? You too, Andy. Take care.
All right.
Yeah. Our buddy Andy Cohn from California. There's other stuff out there. I do have it loaded for when they come back from break. I thought we might just tune in for a minute or so of lunacy from the gang of idiots at this latest GOP pageant. How many more things can they come up with to center one of these pageants around? I mean, aren't they? This is the national security debate. Who in there, including Willard Romney, has even the first clue about national security? I mean, Lord Almighty! It turns out that the Newtsy has announced his team of foreign policy advisors. It's full of people who lobby for foreign governments and the same old tired gang of right-wing, the bomb-em-into-submission weirdos. David Wormser, Elon Berman, James Woolsey, Robert Bud McFarlane? Really? Bud McFarlane, Newt? I mean, I know probably the barrel's getting pretty low, but you had to scrape it with the bottom of the barrel with a trowel to come up with Bud McFarlane. Jesus. This guy goes back to the Reagan administration's National Security Council. He's a criminal. He pled guilty to 4 counts of withholding information from Congress in the Iran-Contra scandal. He was one of the ones who traveled to Iran. And this is a high-powered national security advisor? David in Tennessee writing, he says, the largest-to-be Toyota plant in North America went to Canada some 2 years ago rather than a southern state. The deciding factors, A, no worries about health care expense, B, worker literacy and functionality. And really, if you were some auto manufacturer's CEO, why in God's name would you build in America? You're going to have to, unless you're building in Mississippi or Alabamistan, where you'd, well, no health care for you. No health care for you, Cletus. You and Marveline can just do as what you've been doing. And that'll be just fine, because they're not going to rise up and strike in Alabama. That's not the case. No. No. Some of the bravest liberals I know are southern liberals. But some of the most cowed army ant authoritarian get in line and march when they say march, and when they say froggy, you say how high. That's in the deep south, too. Boy. So, just real quick, let me see if they've come back from their commercial break. Oh, goody, it's Ron Paul.
Their allegiance, and they sacrifice their sovereignty to us, and then they decide they want to bomb something. That's their business, but they should, you know, suffer the consequences. When they bombed the Iraqi missile site, nuclear site back in the 80s,
always going off on Israel. This is always fun.
It's none of our business. And Israel should take care of themselves. Israel has 200, 300 nuclear missiles. And they can take care of themselves. Why should we commit? We don't even have a treaty with Israel. Why do we have this automatic commitment that we're going to send our kids and send our money endlessly to Israel? So I think they're quite capable of taking care of themselves. I think we do detriment. Just think of all the money we gave to Egypt over 30 or 40 years.
There goes Ron Paul being right for the wrong reasons all over again. I'm sure the AIPAC machine will have ginned him up as a straight up anti-Semite by the time this is over. God, CNN has split screen with Herb Cain, and it looks like Herb's trying to swallow a frog. I don't know. He may come over and abuse him or something.
I stated, if the mission and the plan were clear, that it could succeed. But I pointed out that is highly unlikely given the terrain, the mountainous terrain in Iran. But here's the other reason that we should help Israel in an initiative like that. Back to Afghanistan. If we pull out of Afghanistan too soon, Iran is going to help fulfill that power vacuum in Afghanistan, and so it is in our best interest, the United States of America.
Yeah, because Pakistan just disappeared. Pakahu? Who's Becky? Becky? Stan?
Let's stay on this subject, and I want all of you to weigh in. We have another question.
Oh, goody!
Please give us your name.
I'm surprised. Wolf didn't just go slap Ron Paul for that.
Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute.
Oh.
Yesterday, the United States and the UK slapped new sanctions on Iran. But we haven't bought oil directly from Iran in over 30 years. We've had targeted sanctions on Iran for more than half that time.
This is the well-paid 1% wingnut.
Iran is probably less than a year away from getting a nuclear weapon. Do you believe that there is any set of sanctions that could be put in place that would stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
Let's go to Governor Perry. What do you think?
Absolutely. We need to sanction the Iranian Central Bank.
sanction
it? That would be one of the most powerful
ways. Doesn't that mean to approve?
As a matter of fact, Congressman Paul, that is what we need to do before we ever start having any conversations about a military strike, is to use every sanction that we have. And when you sanction the Iranian Central Bank, that will shut down that economy. At that particular point in time, they truly have to deal with the United States.
I'm sorry. I'm having a language moment here. To sanction a bank means to approve of to sanction something means to approve of its actions. He said it twice. He wants to give approval to the Iranian bank.
Over Syria, at the same time, you're putting those types of sanctions against Iran. And in that...
Oh, God, I feel like I've dropped acid. And there's that loopy woman from the American Enterprise Institute, that one percenter. Yeah, Randall noting, my Apple laptop runs Flash on the Snow Leopard OS. Yeah, I wasn't talking about, Mac machines, iPads, iPhones, they won't run Flash because they're so energy intensive. Yeah, Macs will run Flash, yes. Thank you, Marty. Right, I'm talking about iPhones and tablets and so forth, because that's where all the carrying on is. To the phones as we head toward the end of the program. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Mark calling from Ocala.
Hey, Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. I just love listening to your voice. There's something about the tone of your voice. Maybe we should. I'm only 53, Bob, but. Do they teach history in community colleges? I mean...
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, they do.
Well, they do now because they're all four-year colleges, but, I mean, for the last 40 years, I hadn't witnessed them. I've attended to Los Angeles Community College, worked at Chaminade. I went to Onslow Community College in North Carolina. They do in some states, maybe in the last 10 years, but my sarcasm is Newt Gingrich being a history-related community guy, but he's from Kennesaw State, and he's an also to this old Marine, a draft dodger. I would just ask Bob, anybody listening, that I volunteered for Beirut in 1978, before they blew up the U.S. Embassy, and they killed quite a few Marines and civilian State Department folks, and probably Lebanese folks that are sympathetic to the Western way of life, and right after that. And they knew at the school, the Marines were nice enough to us to say that this is a very dangerous post. And they took some guys that were grunts. I was a combat engineer, which was, we make fun of it, looking for landmines with our hands over our ears with our feet. But, but I just wanted any listeners to know that I'm a Franklin Delano Roosevelt Democrat,
right?
A TPA Alabama Democrat, and an FDR Democrat. I am not for nuclear power. I happen to work at one of those crappy plants that we're trying to keep safe. I am for wind and solar, and I share that information. Not just with the two or three people around me, but in any way I can, Bob, on a personal note from me to you. But I have no hatred in my heart towards anyone.
No.
Happy Thanksgiving. I watched Charlie Chaplin. If anybody, I don't know, if you may have caught this, Bob, or I know you would love it if you haven't, but Charlie Chaplin on YouTube, The Dictator, filmed in 1940.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, I don't know why. It just hits my heart. And if you think about it, he's a non... I know you're very smart about a lot of stuff when it comes to that type of subject, but he's a non-speaking actor that's suddenly speaking. I thought he did a great job, for being a little bit older and a little heavier. But I love his voice, and I love the way he spoke, and... I really didn't see this an anti-Hitler thing. I just saw it against dictatorships, and it made me think of the Bush administration and fascism and any.
Well, and Mark, I think you raise a very valid point. We have to consider, from the standpoint of those who do not learn history are doomed to repeat it, we have to consider things like fascism in present context. You can't just assume that because someone is not wearing those nifty black uniforms, or wearing the original field gray fatigues, that they aren't fascists. Just because there's no swastika doesn't mean there's no fascism. And we're watching fascism blossom among the police and security forces of the United States right now. I hate to cut it short, but I have to, brother. Let's find a little time for a little more extended conversation, all right?
All right. Sorry, Bob.
No apology. Just got to roll. Take care, Mark.
God bless.
Bye now. Mark calling from Florida. Listen, one last note. I guess I was too eager, but no, we pulled up $15 short of Susan's challenge in this program this evening. $15, and her challenge will be met. I hope someone can do that. And thank you very much for all of you who have responded to that challenge this evening, and to everyone who makes sure that this program remains on the air. I can never express adequately how much it means, not just to me, not just to the folks who put their time in on a horn, but to everybody who tunes in to the horn. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. A special thanks this evening, Susan. Thank you very much for your challenge. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thank you very much to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. To John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, and official keeper of my technical sanity. And to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, since 2002, preserving liberal, progressive radio on the Internet. And, of course, thanks always to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net.